topic of today's discussion is, as you can tell, is huge. It is way beyond my expertise. But the reason I wanted to tackle it, and I've done this several times, and each time I think I'm never going to do this again because I feel so inadequate and unprepared to do this. But at the same time, it's a topic that just fascinates me, and it stretches my mind in ways that is really fun and exciting for me. And so what I'm going to try to do today is just to convey some of that excitement, just in thinking about the history of our Earth. And try to convey that to you, and give you hopefully a little bit of a takeaway about how scientists view the history of the Earth, and a very, very, very rough sketch of how we think life has evolved on Earth over time, and just maybe a few words about evolution, although that's a huge topic in itself. And I guess the thing, and again, why I decided to do this here is that really geologic time, the idea of geologic time, is really hard to wrap your head around. And when I was in college, it was the one topic that just really fascinated me. We'd be looking at fossils and look at rocks, and the professor would say, well, that, you know, these are this old. And my mind would kind of go off on this trip trying to conceptualize how old that really was. And I also remember as a kid at my grandparents' house, my grandfather had a set of these old Compton encyclopedias from 1928. And they had these beautiful lithographs of some artist's conception back then of what the age of the dinosaurs would like, and they were these very detailed pictures of these fern forests and dinosaurs kind of stomping around in them, and my young imagination just took off to that. But let me start out by throwing it out to you. Maybe this is a topic you don't ever really stop to think about, but if you do, what are some of your concepts of how old the Earth is, and you know, the dim, distant reaches of time, and back when the dinosaurs were living, and how do you think about it? How do you visualize it?
Now, we have four grandchildren, so we usually think about it at the level of a four-year-old.
That's good. Yeah,
seems to be a recurring topic these days.
Now, dinosaurs are sort of a hot topic for four and five-year-olds, aren't they?
When he says that, I don't think of it on a four-year-old level because I don't know the names like they do. I'm not up to that.
Oh.
Yeah, the kids do.
And when somebody, you know, says the Earth is X billion years old, or something in the universe is X billion years old, the thing that I have the greatest difficulty with is that's a big number.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to conceptualize just what that means.
Yeah.
There's no comparable.
It's hard to think about it. I actually have a little exercise here to get help us think about the size of a number like that. We all have a sense of how long a second is in time. Well, if you take 1,000 seconds, let me make sure I remember this right here. 1,000 seconds adds up to 17 minutes. Okay, so we can kind of visualize that. Well, if we then add three more zeros to it and make it 1,000,000 seconds. Yeah. Now, second, you know, they go pretty fast, but if you have 1,000,000 of them, how long do you think it's going to take for those 1,000,000 seconds to go by?
A couple of years.
Well, not quite that much, 11 and a half days. 11 and a half days of seconds. But then we add another three zeros to get a billion, 1,000 millions. Now we're starting to get back there. A billion seconds. Any just off the top of your head, you kind of sense of how many seconds that would be, how long? It's 31 and a half years.
Mm-hmm. So 11 days to
30. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Start multiplying by 10 multiple times.
Yeah.
And you can really push things back. And Molly, I have a favor to ask. I totally forgot to bring down my fossils that I was going to pass around.
All of them?
I don't need, yeah.
Which is fine.
They're all, most of them are in bags, and then there's that one flat red rock that
right.
I wanted to bring.
Right.
The rocks, the regular rocks there, I don't need those. But.
Okay. Anyone got to guess how many seconds that's going to take me?
31 years.
Yeah. So, yeah, a billion is a big number. Any other thoughts people wanted to add at this point?
It's kind of humbling.
Yeah. Yeah.
70 or 80 years in the scheme of several billion is not much.
Yeah. Yeah, we're here for the blink of an eye. You know, one of the reasons I think it's important to tie the history of life into geologic time is because really it was the history of life and the record of life's early history that was recorded in fossils, which was the way in which early geologists first started to try to divide up the past. And they did it by collecting fossils. In the early 1800s, primarily in England, but also in Germany and other European countries, collecting minerals and fossils was quite the rage with well-to-do gentlemen. It was a very popular hobby, but people started really thinking about this. They noticed that in different layers of rock. In England and in Wales and Scotland, which just happened to have a very wide range of rocks of different ages, what they found was that, okay, well, there's this greenish layer and it has these certain type of fossils. And then they would notice that, okay, you know, the next several hundred feet above that, there is a brownish layer and that has some different kinds of fossils. It may have some of the old ones or the previous ones, but may not. And then you've got new ones up there. And they used some logic in saying, well, if sediments, which have turned to rock, like shale and sandstone, if they are laid down and haven't been disturbed since they were laid down, we must be able to assume that there is a sequence that starts at the bottom and works upward. So that as you move up in a sequence of rocks, you are getting younger. And they call this the law of superposition. And it works, except if you're in an area where there's mountain building and the rocks get tilted, and in fact sometimes even overturned, then you've got to be on your toes to catch that. But basically, that works. And so they found these sequences of rocks of, they presumed were of different ages because they were in different positions, and they had different fossils in them, and they started giving them names. And people talk about geologists as, well, all scientists as having too much jargon, and of course, in geology there's lots of that, and so I wasn't even going to give you the names of all these, but they named these different periods for different places, mostly in England, in Wales, where they found these different rock layers. For example, the very first period in the Paleozoic epoch, which is This is the relatively recent part of geologic history which falls here on our timeline. So Paleozoic, Mesozoic, Cenozoic. The very first period in the Paleozoic time is called the Cambrian period. And that was named after the area in Wales called Cambria. So, and that typically that's how geologic formations and time periods get their names. They're named after places. You've probably all seen Jurassic Park. Well, the Jurassic time period in the Mesozoic, right in the middle of the time of the dinosaurs, was named after the Jura or Jura Mountains in Central Europe. So what those early geologists in the 19th century did was give us a sequence. They gave them all these names and they subdivided these periods ad infinitum. They just had lots and lots of subdivisions in this, which really aren't important to us here, but they came up with a relative time scale. And it wasn't until the 20th century when radioactivity was discovered by Madame Curie in the early 1900s, that later scientific discoveries based on radioactivity were able to give us a way of actually assigning absolute ages to things. And we call these radiometric dating techniques, and there are dozens of techniques that are based on this one basic principle. And that is that when a rock is formed, or it doesn't even have to be a rock, it can be a deposit of sand if it contains the right stuff. Something is entombed in that rock that had a certain ratio of elements that had different isotopes, chemical elements that had different isotopes. And they were given an initial ratio based on what was in the atmosphere or what was in the plants at the time, and they knew what that initial ratio was. But then as that rock or that material is entombed in the rock and buried and left there, the radioactive isotopes in the mix will decrease because they decay. There's this thing we call radioactive decay. And so the radioactive part of the ratio gets smaller. So the whole ratio changes, and eventually it'll disappear altogether based on the rate of decay of a particular element. In the work I do, I use a technique called radiocarbon dating, carbon-14 dating. And that's based on the principle that all organic material, plants and animals, you and I, take in, we breathe in carbon, we eat carbon, we become part of the carbon atmosphere that's all around us. And carbon in today's atmosphere and in the water has a certain ratio of a radioactive isotope called carbon-14. Very, very small proportion of the carbon we breathe in carbon dioxide is carbon-14. But it's a very fixed known ratio of that radioactive carbon-14 to the main carbon-12 isotope, which is the stable one. And we breathe it in, we eat it, we drink it, and it becomes part of the tissues of our body. But when we die, we can't take any more in. And so the ratio then of carbon-14 to carbon-12 starts to change. Thank you.
I took a shower and changed my clothes.
So that's one method that I can use. I might be interested in seeing a lahar deposit on the side of a volcano. I want to know how long ago this lahar came down. It's got a stick in there that was broken off a tree and carried with a lahar. So I can send that into a lab. They put in a counter, get the rate at which the count's coming out for the decaying radiocarbon-14, and they can come up then with an age in years, and they can tell me that that, that stick is 2,350 years old, and there will always be a plus or minus with that. The technique has gotten, you know, accurate enough now, so it'll probably be in the range of plus or minus 50 or 60 years. But that gives us an absolute date. We know from historic records when the eruption of Vesuvius occurred in 79 AD, the one that buried Pompeii in Herculaneum. It was a catastrophe of major proportion in the ancient world, and it was well recorded historically. Well, as a test, some years ago, people took pieces of wood and other organic material that was buried in these deposits to see, okay, how good is our technique compared to a historical method? And they got, usually within 5 or 6 years, on a number of different tests in using this radiocarbon dating method, within 5 or 6 years of AD 79. So from that, now carbon 14 is only good because the carbon 14 decays fairly rapidly. It's only good back for about 40,000 years. Anything older than 40,000 years, we can't use carbon 14. We have to use a different technique. But some elements, some isotopes, decay at a much slower rate, so that we can actually go all the way back to the origins of the Earth. And from all these methods, and attacking it from a number of different ways, the number that keeps coming up, and it has a plus or minus on it, but we now think that the age of the Earth is 4.6 billion years. And I'll use a small a on that because that's how we, that stands for annum. And we read that as a billion years ago in scientific writings. So 4.6 billion years is when the Earth pretty much was formed. And as we understand the evolution of the Earth, probably the Earth condensed out of dust that was in the solar system. Stardust, dust of asteroids and things that's floating out there. And gravitationally, this stuff was starting to swirl around the sun, and then the different planets form as concentrations of that dust become localized. And initially, of course, the Earth was extremely hot, extremely hostile place. And it took a long time for it to be possible for life to get going.
Let's see here. Do I need to go back up the hill?
No. just getting organized here. There are some interesting, it's like everything. Obviously, life as we know it today is very complex, and as you might imagine, things had to start very simply on Earth. And also, things had to cool down enough, although life can exist in a very wide range of temperatures and pressures and conditions. Life doesn't need nice, moderate conditions that we need. There are bacteria and even higher life forms that can exist in what we would consider extremely hostile environments. For example, out on the ocean ridges where the ocean crust is splitting apart and new crust is growing, there are these thermal vents coming out with very, very hot water that's full of dissolved sulfide minerals, no oxygen at all in this water. It's about 400 degrees Celsius, which is up around 550, 600 degrees Fahrenheit. And there are clams and worms and starfish that are living in that stuff. And they have evolved to be able to do that. So to fill in our timeline a little bit, and this is based on geological evidence, pretty much all fossil evidence, where people have been looking now for a long time at rocks from all over the world, that we have good strong evidence that, so this is about, I should put some ticks on here to help me stay honest, so that's about 1 billion, 2 billion, 3 billion, 4 billion, something like that. In about 3.5 billion years, we have our first evidence of single cell animals or plants, cyanobacteria. And those fossils are preserved in rocks from a few places in the world. There aren't many places that have rocks that are that old. Australia and Greenland are the primary spots where rocks that old are preserved. So that's, so basically we have bacteria starting, appearing. And this was a pretty durable form of bacteria to the degree that very, very similar bacteria exist today that are like this. And some of these formed colonies, which we call stromatolites, and there are places in the Australian Barrier Reef where you can see stromatolites today. So some of these very early forms have stuck around all these years, and the bacteria basically secrete material that allows them to stick sand and anything that kind of blows in, and it sticks to it, and they form these colonies that have some structure to them. The early Earth's atmosphere was very, very, well, oxygen was absent in the early atmosphere. And so these bacteria didn't need oxygen to live. They used other elements to, chemical reactions with other elements to derive the energy they needed to live. But oxygen levels started to rise dramatically about 2.4 billion years. And some paleontologists call this the oxygen crisis of the early Earth, because many of these guys ended up going extinct, the early ones, because they didn't need oxygen. And in fact, oxygen was poisonous to them. But oxygen started to appear in the Earth's atmosphere, and rose dramatically about that time. At about 1.4 billion years, we have the first complex cells appearing. These would be cells with a nucleus, as they are today. And at about 700,000 years ago, or 0.7 billion, we have our first multicellular organisms appearing.
That would be 700 billion years.
So it would be 700 million years, or 0.7 billion years. And geologists, as I mentioned, that Cambrian period, the first period of the Paleozoic era is the Cambrian. And so all of this time, geologists refer to as the Precambrian. And for a long time, geologists, paleontologists didn't think there was any life to speak of. And really, these discoveries of different types of life during the Precambrian is a relatively recent discovery in the 20th century. And but right here, at this beginning of the Cambrian period, the beginning of the Paleozoic time, there's a remarkable thing happens. In the rocks that are of that age, there is this sudden explosion of different forms of life preserved as fossils in the rock. And the geologists call this the Cambrian explosion. There are hundreds of different species, very, very different from each other, suddenly appear during the Cambrian. And in fact, relatives of all the major life forms today appeared during this period, and some appeared that went extinct, and we don't have any more. One of the ones that is kind of most famous before I do the life forms, I wanted to pass this guy around. This is not a fossil. This is a piece of rock that was a sedimentary rock, a mud. It formed in what is now western Montana. It was in a very shallow sea that when the tide would go out, it would be exposed to the air and it would dry out and it would form mud cracks. And I don't know if you can see there, the mud cracks are preserved in this. There may well be some microscopic fossils of bacteria in this, because this is about 1 billion years old.
You think?
So getting back to this Cambrian explosion, not only were there lots of different types of animals that appeared during the Cambrian, but they're remarkably complex. And one of them is a type of animal called a trilobite. These guys are fairly famous. This one actually was a species that was a little bit later than the Cambrian. But they have basically three lobes. They're a segmented animal. They're a crustacean. And they have well-developed eyes. They have little legs underneath. They'd sort of scoot around in the mud in the bottom of the ocean. And they were scavenger feeders, we think. And there are hundreds of different species of these things that evolved in the Paleozoic. And I'll pass this guy around. So he's about, this guy's about 450 million years old. And just in the last 50 years or so, this period just before the Cambrian, people started looking a lot more closely in rocks that were the right age, and lo and behold, they started finding very faint fossils. In this period, and actually fairly complex ones. So life didn't begin at the beginning of the Paleozoic. It began, or complex organisms didn't begin then, but actually began probably in about 100 million years before. And one of the things that seems to happen throughout geologic time is there are periods of very rapid evolution of organisms when there are environments that are not exploited. In other words, there are no competitors out there. And so life forms start to branch off fairly quickly, geologically speaking, and fill different niches within those realms. During the Cambrian, a lot of different animals got their starts. initially, everything lived in the ocean. There wasn't anything on land. But we had the arthropods, things like the crustaceans, which later other arthropods evolved on land, insects and spiders and millipedes and that sort of thing. Why everything started with this one big explosion in the beginning of the Cambrian is not really known. We don't know for sure why that is. There are several hypotheses. One is that there was a new increase in the level of oxygen in the atmosphere, and then thus in the water. The animals that are preserved in the Cambrian rocks all have shells. The ones before that didn't have shells. So it may be that the chemistry of the water suddenly had changed enough for them to be able to make shells out of calcium carbonate, minerals like that. And then one guy has come up with the idea that this is also about the time that these animals evolved eyes. So maybe this is the time when the predators suddenly got the ability to see their prey. And so there was an advantage to the prey species of having some kind of armor on them so that they could avoid being eaten. And as I'm talking about here and talking about things diversifying and evolving, we're talking about the concepts that really that were first published by Charles Darwin in his theory of evolution and the origin of species. And we have a biologist here, so who knows a lot more about this than I do. But there's lots of ways of looking at this, and it's a very complex subject. But there are three basic points to Darwin's idea. One is that animals and plants reproduce more offspring than will survive. They reproduce more than need to survive. For example, a female cod fish produces 5 million fertile eggs. And obviously, they don't all survive. So there's reproduction excess. The next point is that there is slight variation in offspring. As we know, our kids are not exactly the same, unless we have identical twins. But the offspring of animals vary slightly. And we know now this is due to, for genetic reasons, and how genes, we get mutations in genes, and these slight differences may or may not confer an advantage for survival to a particular offspring. And if there is a slight advantage to survival, even if it's a very, very small probabilistic advantage, the offspring that had those characteristics will go on to reproduce again, whereas the ones that didn't have that get eaten or die for some reason and don't reproduce. So, and that's the third part, that's the selection, that some slight changes offer the recipients a slight advantage in the struggle for existence. And those favorable changes are then passed on to the next generation. So you keep doing that. I mean, we do this when we do, animal husbandry. We select characteristics we want to pass on in animals, whether sheep or cows or dogs or cats, and we breed for that. And we're just greatly accelerating the whole process. And also, let's take dogs, for example. Obviously, not all those changes would win them prizes in the contest for survival. I'm not sure a Pekingese would do too well out there in the real world, should they? But in our case, the selection wasn't sort of for survival. It's been for other characteristics that we value. So So, you know, that's basically what Darwin was saying. So that as oxygen levels change, as water temperatures change, as incoming sunlight changes, the environment is stressing animals and plants that are living. And so if some of them have a little bit better protection or advantage to survive under those conditions, they're gonna continue on. Whereas the ones that don't, their line will peter out. And so that's what we're talking about here. So and also during the Cambrian we had another, well, actually not in the Cambrian, but during the, a little bit later in the, here it is, a little bit later in the Paleozoic, a line of animals called ammonites developed. These are a type of animal called cephalopods related to our squid and octopus today. These were some of their ancestors. They had coiled shells, and they had tentacles that kind of went out behind, and they moved around by jetting through the water like squid do today. This guy is from, actually this guy's a little later. He's from the Mesozoic, but this line first appeared in the Paleozoic. And they became some of the top predators in the oceans. Some of these guys got up to 10 meters long, about 35 feet long. Fish started appearing during the Paleozoic, actually during the Cambrian, early in the Paleozoic, but the first ones didn't have jaws. They had just kind of mouths that would just suck on things. And later, now we're talking into less than 500 million years ago, we started to see things develop. We have the jaw, fishes evolved, and some of the earliest ones of those are sharks. And right early on, there were sharks that were up to 30 feet long, were fearsome predators in the oceans at that time. There were animals called sea scorpions, that basically like somewhat like modern scorpions, but they'd be up to 8 feet long, living in the ocean. Wouldn't want to run into one of those guys. About 400 million years ago, let's see, back up a little bit. The first organisms to actually get out of the ocean and get up onto land were about 470 million years ago. And these were primitive plants related to plants that today we call liverworts. And it wasn't really all that much longer that we got our first land animals. And we have a direct descendant. In fact, this animal, which is the earliest fossil of a land animal, you can go out in the woods here and it's still fine. And they're almost unchanged from that very first one. And that's a millipede. Millipedes, and then slightly after those, centipedes were some of the very first land animals. Vascular plants are able to circulate nutrients up, you know, through their stems and leaves, appeared about 410 million years ago. And those also have come on down through time to us today. Some of them very little unchanged. And those are the ferns and the horsetails. They've been very, very successful plants, a very good design that hasn't had to be improved on much over all this time. They're still able to do very well. And if you or live in a place where you're constantly trying to pull horsetails out of your garden, you know how tenacious they can be. And so on. First amphibians, also in the Paleozoic, 380 million years ago. But we have to go to the Mesozoic to get the first real reptiles and the first dinosaurs, and also the first mammals appeared in the Mesozoic. Right around between 250 and 230 million years ago. When an asteroid collided with the Earth, and we think that is the reason for the mass extinction that ended the Mesozoic period 65 million years ago, most of the dinosaurs died out. But some didn't. You probably know which ones didn't. The birds. Birds are evolved dinosaurs. And this is only a fairly recent discovery by paleontologists who have really gone in and looked in great detail at the anatomy of some of the dinosaurs and their bones. Tyrannosaurus rex is much more closely related to a chicken than it is to, one of the earlier dinosaurs like Triceratops. Dinosaurs were warm-blooded. A lot of dinosaurs had feathers, even before they had wings and could fly. They had feathers to keep warm, because feathers are pretty good insulation. But we also had the mammals going along at the same time. The top predators, of course, were the dinosaurs. They were the biggest and meanest guys on the block. The mammals, for a long time we thought there wasn't anything but little shrew-like, tiny little guys running around, hiding in shadows. But actually, we now know that there were a number of different mammals that evolved during the Mesozoic. Some of them were actually predators, getting up to 3 or 4 feet long, and some of them actually ate small dinosaurs. They found dinosaur bones in the stomachs of some of these fossils, early fossil mammals. Three basic types of mammals evolved during the Mesozoic. The ones that laid eggs, and the duck-billed platypus is pretty much the only remnant species of that type. We have the marsupials that evolved, and most of those now live in Australia, but of course we have the opossum here in North America as well. Their young are born at a very, very primitive stage. They're not very well developed, and so the young have to find their way into the mother's pouch and be protected and raised in the pouch. And then the third type is the placental mammals. Most other mammals are of that type, including us. Apparently there was a fourth type, and I don't know much about it, that went extinct about 50 million years ago. Talking about when the dinosaurs died and this extinction event 65 million years ago, that is not the only big extinction event. In fact, there was one at the end of the Paleozoic period at about 250 million years ago that was really much worse. That one killed 96% of all marine species and about 70% of all terrestrial species, totally wiped out by that. There were four others, and a lot of scientists now think we are perhaps on the threshold of another extinction event caused by us and humans taking away habitat from so many different animals and plants in different parts of the world. The biggest carnivore dinosaur was one called the Spinosaurus. It was actually bigger than the T-Rex. And and there's a tooth from one. This guy weighed 10 tons. Tyrannosaurus Rex only weighed 7.5 tons.
What was the name again?
Spinosaurus.
And where were they?
Well, I think they were pretty widely distributed, although I don't know much about them. And then moving up then through the last period, we call the Cenozoic, from the time at the end of the dinosaurs, from this asteroid impact, and I should mention what that did. We think that that asteroid hit an area that is now Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, made a huge crater, kicked up an enormous amount of particulate matter, dust, into the atmosphere that caused a very severe global cooling that lasted for about a decade. That it was dark, cold, a lot of plants died, and so the food, basically the whole food chain collapsed. And it was especially the big animals that needed a lot of food really couldn't get through that. So, some very good evidence we have that it was in fact this type of impact was that all over the world, right at the boundary between the Mesozoic rocks and the Cenozoic rocks, there is a layer. And I actually was taken on a field trip in a place in Italy where you can actually put your finger on this layer. It's about an inch thick. It's full of ash, charcoal. So there were fires all over the place. And it also contains a big spike in a very rare element called iridium. And iridium is much more common in asteroids than it is on the Earth's crust. And so the conclusion has been that was the breakup of this asteroid is what did that. So then moving on down just this very last little bit of Earth's history through the Cenozoic, human-type animals made their appearance and splitting off from a common ancestor from the chimpanzees about 4 to 6 million years ago. And there have actually been 8 separate human species identified. Ours, the Homo sapiens, the latest is that we appeared about 200,000 years ago in Africa. So I did have one last little exercise I wanted to pass out. And again, a way to try to visualize this deep time, this geologic time. I have a list of some of these events that I've just talked about, events in life history, on the back side of the sheet. So take a few minutes and look at that. And what I'm going to propose is to end up with here is that we try to visualize a timeline, kind of like I've got on the board, but we're going to expand it a bit so we can visualize our time on Earth a little more clearly. And by that, I'm going to define the scale of our timeline as 1 inch equals 5,000 years, which is basically the length of time of recorded human history. 5,000 years, 1 inch. Okay, and let's say that timeline starts out there in the road, and let's then visualize it going back down the road to the lake. And look at that and see where you think some of those events might fall. Just take a moment and then I'll give you those times, or give you those distances, to try to make that a little bit more concrete. And we'll work from the top of the page down. So let's look at the end of the last ice age. It's about 12,000 years ago. That would take us 2.4 inches.
Whoa.
No, not very far. I had in here when modern human beings first recognized that actually the later data, I used 500,000 years for this, and I think more recently Homo sapiens are not quite that old. So, but this will be 500,000 years, and that's 8.3 feet. First appearance of human-like beings, 67 feet. Grass is a fairly recently evolved plant, actually. There were flowering plants for millions and millions of years before grasses appeared. Grasses only appeared, I should have put the years on here too. I think it's about 20 million years ago. 330 feet. Well, you can check me by doing the back calculating that. When that asteroid collided with Earth to cause a mass extinction ending the age of the dinosaurs, 1,050 feet or 0.2 miles. The appearance of the first dinosaurs, 0.7 miles. The appearance of the first amphibians, 1.2 miles. Appearance of the first vascular plants on land, 1.3 miles. First animals to appear on land, okay, those millipedes, 1.4 miles. Earliest evidence of terrestrial life, spores of a primitive plant, 1.5 miles. Multicellular life, 2.2 miles. Those first complex cells, eukaryotic cells, 4.4 miles. And those very primitive cyanobacteria organisms appeared about 11 miles back on our timeline. And to go back to the birth of our planet, we have to go all the way to the lake, cross the lake, go up and over the mountain on the other side. We have to go about 14.7 miles.
Question, about what time did the plates separate?
Well, the plates have been separating and rejoining and separating again and rejoining for a lot of the Earth's history. It wasn't for the whole length of the 4.6 billion years. I can't remember exactly, but I think it's somewhere back around the 3 to 3.5 billion. The whole thing of plate tectonics probably got started. Before that, the crust wasn't well enough for me. So any other...
Wow.
It was a whirlwind, I know. So, any other thoughts or questions or comments? Yeah.
What other events might have been responsible for those mass extinctions besides the asteroid?
Good question. Massive volcanic eruptions is one thought. There have been various times in the Earth's history where basically the Earth has just cracked open and massive amounts of lava have issued forth and spread out over large areas. One of those happened about 65 million years ago in India. They're what we call flood basalts, and they're very similar to what happened in Eastern Oregon and Washington. We had an episode of flood basalts ourselves about between 17 and 14 million years ago. Well, our flood basalts didn't cause anything to go extinct, although it was a pretty big eruption. The ones in India, the Deccan flood basalts, were bigger, and for a while people thought that was, that was what caused the dinosaurs to go extinct, and it may have been a combination, actually. It could have been the asteroid plus the eruption of these basalts, varying slightly in time. And actually, when you get right down to it, the dinosaurs didn't really just disappear on, you know, like on Monday they were here and on Tuesday they were gone. The extinction occurred over several million years. Different species kind of, you know, went out off the record at different times. But it, you know, something had changed that really disrupted things, and it's, there's still a lot of hypothesis being put forward and investigated as to just what causes this. The one at the end of the Permian, we don't really know what that was. Although there is also a layer, a very thin layer, right at the top of the Permian rocks below the Mesozoic rocks, and it is full of carbon. Also, so there was something that had widespread worldwide fires at that time. But there's also a lot of fungus spores. It's full of fungus. So it was also a time when something happened, and the fungus, various kinds of fungus, were then able to really bloom and take over. We don't really understand what that means. Or why. Well, thank you all for joining me for this breathtaking tour.